All right. So this is Women Talking About Women Talking. It's one of my favorite titles of this. This is a bonus episode in the season of the podcast on clergy sexual abuse. So again, we always want to remind people in this season to take it easy, to give yourself permission to take a break. Things shared in the context of the movie, as well as the context of our thoughts, might be triggering or traumatic. So please take care of yourself. So consider yourself warned in all the best possible ways. I'm joined by Lori Ann and Ange, and we all saw the movie, Women Talking. If you don't know about Women Talking, it is nominated for Best Picture for Oscar. So you soon will. It is a very, very important movie. I think there's something profoundly good about this movie and challenging and disturbing. So we're just going to talk through some of the themes that might have challenged us or raised some of our questions or really gave some light to some of the things we've been journeying through in this recovery process and exposing process of abuse. So that's what we're doing. I'm excited about it in terms of hearing some of your thoughts as you watched it. I actually have some little notes that my friend who came with me took while she was at the movie to remind me of some of those scenes. And since the movie, my husband was quite intrigued. So he looked up all the real stories. And so we had long conversations about the real story that this was sort of premised by. And I guess one of the first things out of the gate, if it's okay with you guys, is that I wanted to kind of talk about that because I don't think I fully understood that line at the start of the movie that says this is based in a real event, but this movie is a product of female imagination. Mm-hmm. And I remember at the time, because I wanted to just go fresh. I didn't want to go in knowing all the things. So I just went in fresh. But I remember going like, what? Like, what does that even mean? What? And so now I think I understand what they meant. And that, even just that phrase, like this is a product of female imagination, is a very powerful idea of like, if we could dream about a future that's different for women and generations of women, it would look something more like this. And I thought just even that was a very powerful opening. Like this is us saying things could be, should be, might be, it's possible for them to be different.
Mm-hmm. Precisely. How can we as women in this world rewrite the script or flip the script?
You know? Right.
Well, that's what's so powerful about that phrase was that whoever crafted that phrase for that use in this movie was reusing the very phrase that had been weaponized against the women in this colony, that they had been saying horrible things had happened to them. And the men of the colony had told them it's female imagination. You're just, yeah. So they took the same phrase and reimagined a use of it by making this movie. Oh,
That's cool. I mean, I actually hadn't even thought about that. But that's really neat too, is like, actually you want to talk about female imaginations? We can imagine a better world than this, right? Yes. Like that. Wow. Wow.
And I mean, that can be actually traced even deeper and further back in history where women were bringing forth allegations about their, you know, their fathers, their brothers, their uncles, their community members. And they were called hysteric. Histrionic, that we reinvented these things. So the idea that women have invented sexual violence as a figment of their imagination is centuries, it's millennium old.
Wow.
I also think what you're referring to, Danielle, about the forward use of that phrase is so powerful because one of the great tragedies of the oppression of women is that women-specific thinking is not in the mix. That in my experience and what I observe off of other women, there's this sensation of like the real conversation is happening here and women's voices are like gnats around it. Like, hello. So when you think about the power of the female imagination, it isn't just the what kind of wondrous things are in the minds of women.
Yeah.
But also, like, the success of this movie is so exciting to me because this product of female imagination is now in mainstream spaces being hopefully chewed on and thought about. And and we have to get the female imagination at the table, not just trapped. Because I think the oppression of women, like, suppresses the female imagination. But even with that oppression going on, what's in our heads is not useful to the world at large if it isn't at the table, actually being assessed, actually being worked with, actually in the mix.
Actually being valued.
Yeah.
I was also thinking about, you know, I my whole life was sort of very impacted by Gunilla Ekberg, who's like a social reformer for women in Sweden. She changed the country's laws and perspectives around sexual exploitation in Sweden when everybody was like, you know, let's just call that empowerment. And I said to her, you know, how did you change a nation's mind? Like, I mean, this is a big deal. And she said there were two things necessary to change nations. I was like, that's a hilarious thing to know and just to say over coffee at a conference. But anyway, she said, you've got to be able to imagine a better world. And then you have to understand oppression. And if you can do those two things, you can shift everything. And then if you couple that, so Gunilla Ekberg, you know, feminist, social justice advocate. But then I was reading like Walter Brueggemann's Prophetic Imagination, where Walter Brueggemann says, if there is any hope of transformation in our world, the church has got to figure out how to live a better way. Like, the church is the potentially, this is the calling of the prophetic nature of the church, is to live this alternative reality in real time. Which then, of course, this movie, if people don't know, this movie is based on a closed Mennonite, extremely Orthodox community. And the original story is actually in Belize, I think. But this is reimagined to be like a North American context. And the women are being repeatedly terrorized and raped. They're being drugged. And then they're waking up sort of in the state of like terror. And they keep saying, reporting these things and sharing these things. And then they're told, these are demons. This is your imagination. Like, this is you. And then finally they catch one of the guys in the act. And then that guy ends up telling on the other people who were part of this. And the movie, so the imagination part is the guys are taken to jail. All the men go to sort that. And the women have this kind of 2-day window to decide what they're going to do. And in that 2 days, they have to decide, they're given three kind of categories for response. One is to stay and do nothing. One is to leave. And one is to fight, to stay and fight. So those are kind of the do nothing, leave, or stay and fight. And they select three different family sort of groups on their behalf to discuss and to kind of finalize, like, what are we going to do? What is our response going to be? And the whole movie is this kind of dialogue between these three families and all these different aspects of like what's going on in their mind, what their capacity is, like what the struggles are, what their doubts are, where their faith is, until they make this final decision about what they're going to do. So it's all kinds of fascinating. And what were the things for you two that you thought were like, oh, this is something that we need to say more about or highlight? Or you're glad it was highlighted, or?
Brian, do you want to go first?
Sure. I have never seen one representation be so comprehensive in its addressing of the various faces and effects and characters that are involved in an abuse situation. Mm-hmm. So I mean, the fact that it was made in an engaging story form is so helpful. So I love documentaries, but that's not everybody's thing. So I was so grateful to see an engaging, entertaining, piece of art that comprehensively, I mean, it covers domestic violence, it covers sexual violence, obviously, but then the various characters that are necessary, because it's tempting to believe that there's an abuser and a victim, but in truth, every single time abuse happens, there are other players in the space that are either standing by and permissioning it in some way, shape, or form, or actually perpetuating it. And then there are dynamics. So victim blaming and all of the mindsets, like there are multiple things that have happened before this moment to set up the potential for abuse to happen like this. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen one piece so comprehensively addressed. When it is available for me to have in my own home, part of my process will be to watch that and pause it at a bunch of different places in order to just name. I mean, I tried to keep up as the movie was unfolding, but to actually name, oh, this is that ramification of abuse, or this is that lead up, like that mentality is what permissions this stuff to happen, or these circumstances. Anyway, so I was compelled by this piece of art and critique, social critique. I also think it's helpful.
Just pause there for 1 second, because I think the moment for me in the film that sort of helped that like multi-complex problem around how abuse flourishes kind of like or rages was when the one woman said, we can't just have a conversation about getting out of abuse. We have to have a conversation about what we want.
Yeah.
Kind of like, what do we act? What is the vision? Like, what do we want? And then in that conversation is where, you know, like we want girls to be able to go to school, for example. So that's one of the uneducation, like keep right. girls out of a learning center. That's one of those complicated, like one of those factors of a community that, you know, patriarchal misogyny that's happening. We want women to have a vote. We want to have a say. We want to actually do collaborative decision-making. And so as they began to name their vision for the future, what was clear was this like, oh, I see how this happened. Like there are layers upon layers upon layers of conditioning and social acceptance here that makes, you know, abuse just kind of the tip, not the root. It's not the root. The root is all these others. So that was in the movie. That was where I went, that's an important part of this conversation.
The exact phrase that they use, and I wrote it down, I found it so compelling what you're referring to. It says, the woman said, we need a statement for what we are fighting to achieve, not just for what we're trying to destroy.
Right.
And I think that it's been my observation over the course of a long protracted period of time that oftentimes in advocacy communities, we can only look to what we're trying to destroy. Mm-hmm. And if we get caught looking back exclusively and not looking forward to what are we trying to actually build as opposed to what we're trying to kill, then we end up actually in many ways becoming we end up trading hats and becoming oppressors, right? Mm-hmm. Ourselves, because we're only looking to destroy rather than to bring life. Mm-hmm.
And it also centers, it also continues to center the wrong thing. So I deeply resonate with what you're saying, because when we're only looking at the thing that needs to go, it still keeps that oppression at the center of our existence.
Exactly.
And that is not flourishing. There's no flourishing to be had there.
There's no liberation if the oppressor remains at the center of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
The other thing that there's so many aspects. I agree with both of you that from 10,000 feet up, that this has prongs in every possible direction for every single possible conversation you could have about abuse, about victims, about survivors, about predators, about justice, about faith, about cognitive distortions, about perversions of faith, about sexualization of spirituality. Like, just hold the phone, right? Mm-hmm. But right out of the gate, I wanted to say this. It's very clear that sexual violence is perpetrated against victims, that it's a choice. It's not a choice. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think that the first conversation that happened in the movie, and I think sometimes the first conversation that we must be having, other than are you stable? Are you okay? What do we do next? Is what are we going to do about the situation? Mm-hmm. Right. And so part of processing, do we do nothing? Because doing nothing is an option. Right? Do we stay and fight or do we leave? The women at that start, when they started to vote about those three options, most of these women, all these women were illiterate. They had to do a piece of paper with pictures of their options. You know, they were then from the get-go, the survivors and their families were involved in what are we going to do? They were involved in recreating agency, recreating choice. Everybody was heard. And so I think that they model right from the gate, how do we decide and who gets to decide what happens here? I thought that was super powerful, right? Just from the starting.
Yeah. At the very beginning, it was like an X. Every single one of them put an X on the picture that they wanted. And then basically they boiled down to two, stay and fight or leave. And then they got families to represent them, which one of my friends also, her observation of, you know, the complexity of these situations, you know, I feel like whenever we hit complexity, what we want to do is we just want to go like, this is right and this is wrong. And we just throw everything out. So like in that situation, this Mennonite community that has so many parts of it that actually are good. So this is interesting. The screenplay, the woman that wrote the screenplay is Mennonite. And this is fascinating because, and so for example, a deep faith, right? So many people who are abused in religious communities just throw all of it out because they're just like, it's all gone now. This cannot be good. And I think part of the nuance of that movie that I so resonated with and I thought was so good was the way that they held the space. It's still tense. You're not even sure quite how you feel about it. Like they launch into a hymn, for example, and you're just like, really? We're going to sing a religious, like all the children, you know, which again, the hymn that they picked is like, you're thinking about all this abuse happening and you're singing these things that aren't true. And you're just like, ah, and all of us just want to go like, make it go away. But they don't, they hold space. And even that idea of collectively, you know, we're going to choose this together is like one of the things I've observed that happens in places and communities that are abusive is that victims are on their own. They're just on their own. Like you have to decide all these things by yourself, for yourself. And one of the things that the Mennonite community, those values that they held in that work of imagination was what if this collective idea that we're in this world together and we have to make a new world together actually worked for victims, like actually worked for the people that were suffering rather than like, cause that's one of the things I've observed is like, you're a victim, you're on your own, you're ostracized from your community. You're making decisions on your own for yourself. But that imagination, like imagine, and this, I guess at the heart of Hagar's voice, what we're imagining is imagine if we got together and we did this for and with each other and you weren't just so on your own, you know? So just that collective piece was powerful to me too.
Yeah, tremendously powerful. And so absent, you know, agreement and in actual ordinary spheres.
I was incredibly grateful, although it added to the complexity of the movie, but I was incredibly grateful that this piece was based in a religious space because the dynamics that you're talking about, where it is so confusing to experience what is antithetical. I mean, it seems completely impossible that abuse could be happening in a space like this. Mm-hmm. So then the survivors, but also those around who are trying to figure out how to advocate and whatever. But Lori Ann was sitting next to me when the first hymn came on. I don't know, maybe you were having your own moment, but I was shaking the seats with crying from my own mixed emotions of this, you know, religious singing has been a place of comfort, a place of hope, a place of, you know, that song, you're right. The first hymn that they chose to sing was a scathing critique against the community that they were in. It was all about the safety of God for God's children. Mm-hmm. And here they are sitting, completely experiencing the utter opposite of that and still holding on to hope. And yeah, anyway, so I my own experience made that incredibly complicated. And I was grateful that the space provoked some questions for me. But I'm grateful for the same thing for people who are wrestling through what parts can I trust and keep? What do I know to be true, even if, you know, I have heard? Because I think part of the problem is we have decent rhetoric about what the church is supposed to be and community is supposed to be. And then when we experience something utterly different than that, like not just like, oh, this plus something, it's literally not possible to believe this and do that.
Yeah,
it is like maybe the whole thing is false. Like you can understand why survivors are like, wait a second, I actually believed what you taught me to believe.
Right.
And then you taught me something wholly different. I guess I can't believe any of it. Anyway, I'm just incredibly grateful that this thing took place in a religious context, because that is a real wrestling match for survivors to find the space for themselves.
Yeah.
What can I keep and can I trust and can I hold?
One of the things I was going to say is that, you know, if we're paying attention to the history of overcoming oppression, we learn the most about this redeeming music as a form of actually telling the truth from our Black and brown brothers and sisters around the world, and particularly Black culture. And that's one of the critiques of the movie that I thought was really interesting and worthy of saying is, you know, a lot of Black advocates were saying, really, your female imagination couldn't make room for a multiracial, which again, you can see as a movie, they're trying to keep the dynamics of this, like this is an in exclusive cult. So you're trying to keep it like within this culture. But a lot of the other folks were saying like, this is going to have to be. And so even that idea of like singing those hymns, you know, just echoing back to like, you know, people being, you know, pummeled by oppression and racists and singing like we will overcome. You know, you're just like, no, those can't go together like that. You what? Like, but it can. And that it ends up, they take this song and make it an anthem of imagination, like an anthem of truth. So I loved, that was kind of a nod, I felt like, to that kind of like how you loosen that oppressed religious sort of garb and you actually claim it back. Like, we're going to sing this as though it's true. I love that. But that was the one critique about that movie that I thought was a good critique. I understand why it doesn't exist because they're trying to, you know, recreate that situation. But they did say, you know, you do start with this as an act of female imagination and your imagination couldn't include some kind of diversity. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's whatever critique that is of the movie. In my opinion, that is a far more scathing critique of the state of the church right now.
Yeah.
That movie was maybe very segregated in its exclusivity of who was featured in it. But that's actually not that different from what's actually happening in our modern society. We are not able to lean on each other's perspectives and to actually, anyway, so that's fair.
Yeah, I agree with everything each of you have said. At the same time, there is also okay to acknowledge that within different strains of faiths, even within different cultures within the same faith, so whether it's Mennonite or Protestant or Catholicism or Afrocentric communities or brown communities, there is different dynamics that play out. There are different pieces of the cultural pie that those communities actually have the right to bring forward and should be the voices bringing forward the Afrocentric perspective. A bunch of white people have no business, you know, co-opting that. But at the same time, it's okay to feature the Mennonite experience. And then to be, if we have complex enough minds to be able to say, oh, these themes we share in common.
Yeah.
And exactly. These aspects are different, as opposed to saying, well, where was I in your story?
Like, well, that's what I think is cool is that that's a really good picture of how oppression works too, is that segregating people from others. Like that's part of that backdrop of that story is this, like, it's exclusive, it's segregated, we don't. And so the real story actually is not only are they not, do they not read or write, but the dialect they chose to speak in that community was different from any other dialect. So even the idea of trying to talk to somebody, you know, you speak a different language, which for those of us who grew up in, you know, exclusive church, like this is true. You don't know how to, you've seen other people who might offer you hope and belonging and as sort of an enemy for a long time. So even that idea of anyway, I thought that exclusivity of the community was a big backdrop of like, if you keep doing this us and them and you're apart from, you know, that extreme idea of like isolation from anything other than what you know, that's really bad situation for you. Like, this is not going to work out well.
That the one aspect of that from the movie was that the women had no access to a map. They had literally never seen a map. And mm-hmm. So practically speaking, they would not know where to physically go if they were to leave. And that's its own thing. I was really struck by that train of thought in here, because I feel like that's what most survivors actually feel like. So what they talked about was, well, without a map, we don't even know where we are, where we are in our world, where we are in the world. And as we interact with survivors who have been gaslit for a long time, and women who have been part of a patriarchy that says certain things about them, there's so many dynamics for most survivors that literally, like, not understanding the ecosystem of abuse, not being able to name grooming, even outside of their own story, let alone inside of their own story, in so many ways, that map concept applies to survivors.
They don't have a map.
Do not know where they are in the story. They're not honestly even sure if they are the victim or the villain. Yep. So often they cannot, because society has its narratives about women and the sexualization of women. Anyway, that particular tiny little strain of the movie where they talked repeatedly about their lack of access to a map, I just deeply resonated with the reality of that for modern women in so many ways.
Then they get a map, but what's cool is how they navigate is with the stars, which I thought was a pretty powerful, like, there's an immovable way to direct your life. There is a light that's not going out that can guide you in the way that you, and what it guides you is to find north, you know? And I thought that was a very powerful image too. And because if you, in the movie itself, if physically the way they film this is so beautiful, and also just like, because they use light and the absence of light to communicate the passing of time. So you can see in the movie, everything's getting darker, darker, darker as this time is passing. And then there's that moment where she knows where she is. It felt like the map was about knowing where you are. The navigation of the stars was about where we're going to go. And I thought, oh, wow. Get like, yes, please. Like, there is a way for you to get out. There's a navigation system that is immovable, untraceable. Like, they could burn that map and you still can find your North Star and run. You know, I just was like, oh, that was so powerful.
I loved, in keeping with the idea of, you know, so much of what the work to do in this traumatic landscape is to orient ourselves, because it's so desperately disorienting and we don't have a compass. There is no map, and gosh, the territory is a bloodbath. And so one of the very first things to come to terms with is language. And one of the quotes that I wrote down is that the narrator, the young girl that was narrating, said, you know, where I come from, we didn't talk about our bodies. There was no language for it. With no language, there was a gaping silence. And in that silence was the real horror.
Yeah, that's one of my notes too. Without language, there is a gaping, wow.
Gaping silence. And in the silence was the real horror. And that's the lived reality of every sexual violence survivor, and how they can coagulate the hemorrhage of harm into some sort of language that they can, at a minimum, utter internally, but absolutely necessarily utter externally.
Yeah, that naming, like language for, which is why I think, you know, the more we keep talking about abuse and what it is and how it works and grooming and all, like the more that we do this, the more possibility people have to begin to go, that's what this is. And some of that like gaping, silent horror can actually dissipate because there's some, you know, words matter. It matters to speak. It matters to speak your truth. It matters somehow, you know, it matters to get this out, you know. Amazing.
There's also, so there's the silence of a lack of language, but in this conversation, what I'm tuning into is the silence that is the bad ratio between when we know that one out of every three women has experienced some form of abuse. The size of the conversation around that being that gap also is a screaming silence where the horror is sitting. I don't know if that's making any sense, but like, this is how big the abuse statistics are and reality is. Yeah. And this is how big the conversation is. That silence, that is also where the horror.
Yeah. Lives. So individually it's there, but also you're saying like society, culture. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
The same dynamics that play out in an individual situation, play out in an institutional situation, play out in the public stage, play out in a national and international situations. The dynamics are exactly the same, just the expanse, the reach, the radius is bigger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is why I think actually this is also for me, some bells are going off in terms of like why it's such a struggle to name. For institutions and places. Like why? Because I remember going through that going like, why is this hard? Like we all agree this is what it is. Like, why can't we say it? I remember just going like, I don't understand why you can't just say what it is. And it's that silence, we will not, you know, that whole thing is like its own raging kind of fight to just get to a place where you're like, oh, that's what it is. Like to name it is so powerful. And it's a fight to get there. It's fascinating.
I also love the aspect of the movie where there were three different families and you could see those families. There was disagreement within the families, but you could see those families' value systems come out as they argued what their options were. So in the movie, everyone had taken a vote, but the two options that had tied each other were the ones that were on the table for discussion throughout the movie. So they had voted and there were more votes and equal votes for stay and fight versus go. And so that's what these three families were tasked with. And I was so grateful that there had been a variety of approaches inside of that as they argued out the various merits, which, you know, you could say, you should say that the right to decide, to your point, Leanne, the right to decide needs to be in the hands of the people who have experienced this. But even within this, in modern context, as well as in the movie, survivors of the same exact abuse have wildly different desires on what comes next, like, and wildly different reasons for why they're experienced. So I was so grateful that they had actual conversations around the fact that one of the women at least was named as having ended her life because she could not live with this. Yeah. And then another character in the story was having panic attacks, and another character had been completely passive. Like they knew that her husband was dangerous and was completely passive. And another survivors were blaming her for that. And anyway, I was so grateful that they let that conversation be varied, because the same abuse produces very different desires inside of the responses of survivors. And we're tempted to think that ours is the right one. And so you must be a coward for not wanting to take action, or she must be weak because she cannot cope with this the way that I'm coping with this. And in that, we get, again, I think, Danielle, I think it was you who said oppression segregates us or silos us. And I think our misunderstanding of the sacred other causes survivors to look on other survivors and their various responses in a way that divides us and lessens our voice, lessens our sense of solidarity, you know, and obviously the loss of empathy and things is not good on the human spirit, but also keeps our voices quieter because we have made assumptions across the space. And I was really grateful that the movie directly addressed that and called us all to the universal empathy and sacred other, that I don't have a right to stand in judgment at your inaction. Now, I did love that the woman who was like, I just don't understand why you're even talking about action at all, but she had been a victim of domestic violence on top of this sexual violence that the whole colony was having. And they were all unified in like, you should have done something long before this. And the movie gave us the opportunity for her to finally have her perspective and her say, which also hopefully we trail down this path for a second, also gave them the opportunity to repent of the judgment that they had done. And actually the apathy of them standing on. So while they were standing back, judging that survivor for not having yet used her agency to stop the domestic violence in her home, it had divided them. But also the movie gave us an opportunity to see them apologize, repent, unify.
Knowledge.
Actual correction of what had gone wrong. So
She actually says, which I thought was so powerful, where she said, in what universe has this been a choice?
Yeah.
Like, in what planet have I been able to choose this? Like this, what? And so it's like this, like micro domestic violence being this kind of helpful tool for this, what's happening actually collectively is the same thing. Yeah. Is on what planet has this been a choice I've chosen? Like, and then there's a flashback. I don't know, Angela, you and I talked about this, but there's a flashback where her mother actually repents because she's kind of been, part of the system that's allowed this to happen for so long. And there's a flashback she has because she has false teeth that don't fit her properly. I don't know if which is its own whole, she keeps taking out her teeth. It's its own whole
trauma.
In the backdrop story that flashes back is her losing her teeth, which looked to me like a domestic violence situation. It wasn't like super clear, but then you also begin to see the generational, and this has been one of the things I've really been surprised, not surprised, like maybe pleasantly surprised at how this generation's ability and willingness to name what's happening has actually started to liberate people from the last generation who didn't have language, didn't have capacity, just dismissed it all. So like, I remember in her 80s, a woman contacting me saying like, thank you so much. I thought I had an affair with the pastor for my whole life. And it wasn't until I heard Hagar's statement on the, you know, that I even connected the dots that was not me. I didn't do that. I didn't cause that. And she's just coming to her own awakening. I just thought, oh gosh, another woman like in her 60s who contacted me, who had like memories of, you see this kind of like, as we find language and are able to begin to talk about this, then this frees generationally, you know, it has impact in both directions.
Yes.
One of the other lines from the movie said, I wrote it down here. It says, only the grandchildren arrive at the destination.
Oh yeah. That whole butterfly. Yeah.
Remember? The butterflies are migrating and only they go so far. That's the quote, is they end up going so far around the world that only the grandchildren arrive at the destination. And it's this like long-term view of like where we're headed. And I also thought it was so cool that it actually also goes back.
Yeah.
And it liberates people behind us, even as well as people in front of us.
I agree with everything you've said. It's a universal truth that victims almost immediately always blame themselves. And part of that is because of the setup, unless it's been like an overpowering situation. But even then, I shouldn't have been there. I should have been wearing that. I shouldn't have been drinking, you know, those sorts of things. And so even this generation, so I talked to survivors on the regular in the job that I do. And universally, it's because of some exposure in the media, or somebody's doing a podcast, or they heard something, or they read something, and they're like, wait a minute, hold on. You're right. That wasn't me. But even young people still, like they're coming to terms with it faster. And they're looking for justice sooner, you know, not in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. But I think it is a universal truth that the victims initially very often will blame themselves. Mm-hmm. I thought it quite beautiful that these women didn't. Mm. And striking. And nobody there, nobody in the movie blamed themselves for what happened to them. They could all see they were being perpetrated against.
Well, they blame that one. Remember, they actually call the one woman a whore.
Oh.
Remember, because she was pregnant.
And she wasn't married.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And recall that was like, I heard that not as you are a whore, as we all feel defiled.
Yeah.
Right? Because all of them were.
Yes. Like
everyone in the building were sexually violated.
Yeah.
Right. So I didn't take that as you are a whore. How could you sleep around? Because it happened to everybody. Everybody in the room had sexual violence perpetrated against them. Yes. I took it as a projection of, we all feel.
No, that's good. That's actually an interesting, because that is the journey of a survivor, is that like, it's my fault. Mm-hmm. And there seemed to be, it felt like the movie was starting at the place where they finally connected the dots. So there's probably like a whole journey before that where everyone's suffering in their own.
You can reference it, because that's why the Claire Foy character, who is full of rage, which also I would love to talk about the emotional bandwidth of this movie.
Yeah.
And the permissioning of rage, and also the call to something else. Like, oh gosh. But anyway, the Claire Foy character, she has to give an impassioned speech that says, we all know we did not make this up. And they all reference the fact that previous generations, they point back saying, for a long time, we believed that these were demons. We believed so. They do reference the fact that they had at one time all questioned themselves. But you're right, the bulk of the movie gives space for the voice that does not question itself, but then does have to still figure out what to do. Yep. Even after you're like, this is not my fault, there's still this robust conversation that's needed. Yeah. Lorianne, I just saw your face when I was like, the emotional range of this movie, you want to go there? Oh, my.
Yeah, I think that we, especially in communities of faith, we don't grant ourselves the permission, the compendium. Women are seen as histrionic if they have more than a peaceable emotions. Certainly survivors are, traumatic symptoms are often labeled as being, people being unwell or mentally unstable or crazy. And if we're crazy, it's because you made us like that, but we're not, the reality is that, these are things where rage is an appropriate activating response. It's not where we end. And many times it's not where we begin, but that is a season where it has to be processed.
Yeah.
100%. I also, it's weird that the people who are anti-anger are always the ones that are in control, right? So like, of course you're anti-anger. Like if we gave permission to be angry about things that are wrong, you're in trouble, right? So there's also that, I feel like in a faith conversation, like, have you just not read the Bible? I mean, it just feels like, are you just not reading your Bible? Because there's a lot of emotion. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of rage. I mean, the precatory Psalms alone are like, we almost find it difficult to read because they're so rage filled against
violence.
Yeah. So I think I just think it's interesting, but that one, what I thought was cool is that one woman, everyone gave permission for her to be like, and she started to describe in the movie, which is the other backdrop of this Mennonite community, is they're communal and they're very cult. They're very, like, one of the main tenets of their faith is nonviolence, which is what makes this whole thing egregious on multiple levels, because this is violence. So these men have been violent, like this is a violent crime. But then also this person is describing what she would do if one of these men came after her daughter. know if you remember this part. It's like, oh, yeah. Tear him limb from limb. I would stab him through the, like, she just like,
lets
yeah. And just like lets out this, what all of us feel. If someone would, like, if you were going to do that to my son, I would feel the exact, I would, you know, I pity the fool, you know? So, and as she's discussing what she's going to do, I thought this was such a powerful part of the movie where it's like, she even comes to this and it becomes clear that staying and fighting is not an option. Because, and this, Lorianne, you mentioned this early, because if we stay in this spirit for too long, if we let this rage drive us, we become the oppression that oppressed us. We end up causing violence. We end up causing harm. And this is where I even in the movie, and then even since, as I've sort of thought about it, I've thought like that leaving is a real strategy sometimes. If even to stay and to fight, to stay and do nothing is to allow violence to keep perpetuating itself on you and your generations. So that's off. But to stay and to fight sometimes might be possible, but to stay and fight for the most part is to let that, is to allow that kind of rage to fuel you in such a way that you lose your own values and your own system. And the line they kept saying, which I thought was really cool, was leaving, leaving will help the size of our faith be stronger than the rules. So they actually keep talking about this. The size of their faith can be stronger than the rules or than these like accepted conditions of the society. And I also love that this was not an abandoning of their faith.
Right.
This was a strengthening. This was actually them being led by their faith beyond this, you know, the contraptions of the social situation.
It's a powerful, what happened there was that their faith, through a lot of processing, not a one-time conversation, allowed them to, and actually mandated that they leave. Their principles of nonviolence mandated that the actual only option it was to exit stage left. Mm-hmm. And what happened there is a way that, you know, You folks live within a religious space and a religious community, but many people who are dealing with abuse victims don't. And so they're coming into, say, an alternative faith and wondering, how can your faith leave you in this situation? And many times we will poo-poo or dumb down, you know, how can you serve a God that will allow you to stay in these sorts of things? Rather than coming alongside and examining the tenets of somebody's faith and asking them just very simple questions of congruence and incongruence. You know, honoring that their faith, whether we believe it or not, but also reflecting back their faith and how does it apply in this situation, in the present and in the future? Mm-hmm. So it's to be culturally appropriate in our own faiths, but also with other people's faiths as well.
Right. Yeah, I love the idea of their faith leading them, mm-hmm. And again, that's part of that. That's part of that tension in the movie where they hold space for the faith not to be the problem necessarily, but the behaviors and the misappropriation and the control and the abuse is the problem within that construct.
Well, in the plot line of the movie, the angry character at the beginning, they were all annoyed of like, here you go back up on your soapbox. Like at first it was like, okay, we have to sort of put up with her rage in order to get to the meat of the conversation that we want to have. But then that's the character who, in her vulnerable confession, she says, I will become a murderer if I stay here. And she's crying and is like brokenhearted about what she knows to be true. Mm-hmm. And that's the moment where the rest of the community, and that is the pivot point, that's the moment where the rest of the community decides to reframe faith.
Yeah.
And what is so powerful to me is that they were willing to relook at their definition of faith because of their solidarity with her.
Yeah.
And they also could then recognize, because her vulnerability led everyone to understand, if we stay here, it will alter us. It will alter us in a way that doesn't match the faith that we proclaim.
Yeah.
But it was her vulnerability. It was the angry character who got us to this point. Oh, I just...
And then you remember the hymn that kind of sealed the deal there was "Nearer My God to Thee."
Yeah, beautiful.
Which I also thought was powerful because true faith, you know, in a Christian context, which is where the movie's set in and where my setting is, my goal is to be true and faithful and tight with Jesus. And the nearer I am, the freer I become to follow him and leave behind things that I would have once thought maybe were essential, but are not, and actually mostly in the way. So I thought that was also a very powerful, moving moment where they sang that hymn in the recognition that to be nearer to Jesus in this moment meant to exit their community.
Uh-huh. Well, there's a mass exodus in the church.
Uh-huh.
In the
Christian women, shocker.
And part of the reason why, you know, Dr. Jennifer Frye talks in her theory of betrayal trauma, where when we see betrayal, when we actually see it, when we're not blind to it, the most natural response is to leave.
Mm-hmm.
If it cannot be reconciled,
then
the most natural human response is, this is not safe, I must go.
Yeah.
And we tend to make that then, we demonize people who exit because they can't reconcile the betrayal in their midst. And the church is not doing a good job of repair.
Right.
I'd just like to go back to like the natural human response. We sometimes in church spaces see that as the fallen nature, but I would just like to, if I could add to your sentence, the natural human God-designed impulse in response to betrayal is to move towards safety.
Like, yes.
This is not safe. And you're absolutely right that we're still writing the narrative. Just like the characters in the movie were like, if we live, we'll be abandoning our faith. The modern church that is experiencing this mass exodus is also writing the narrative that the people that are leaving religious institutions that are full of corruption and abuse are also moving away from their faith. Rather than it is their faith that is compelling them out of these spaces 100%. That are exploiting and abusing.
There's a great scene in Diana Butler Bass's book, Freeing Jesus. I can never unsee this now that I saw it as I read this thing, but she's sitting in a church and she sees a picture of Jesus on the wall. And she says, I looked at the picture and Jesus looked at me and said, can you get me out of here? Gosh.
Okay,
anyway, it feels a bit like that. Like, can we leave here? Because I can lead you. The other thing we didn't talk about, but this is at the very beginning of the movie, but I think this is the context where it fits too, is where the one woman who's really like fully all the way in, Frances McDormand, what a great role. And she says emphatically, like, we cannot leave. We must forgive. Because we will not get to heaven. Like, this is our only way to be saved, is to forgive these people. And one of the women says this line, if forgiveness, what does she say? Just a second, I wrote down here. If forgiveness, is forgiveness forced upon us really forgiveness? And it's that, and I thought that was a very powerful line too, because this forgiveness forced is not, again, it's this removal of autonomy, removal of choice, removal of faith. This is just this is compliance again. This is not any sense of like a faith-filled venture to freedom. That's not what this is. This is just, you must comply with this. And I thought that was also very powerful. No, forgiveness forced upon you, which of course is everyone's response right away, is like, oh, you've got to forgive. Oh, you've got to forgive. And you're just like, stop it. Forgiveness forced upon people is not forgiveness.
Well, that's weaponized forgiveness. Yeah. It's weaponizing Jesus's principle of liberation.
Yeah.
But the same thing is happening around unity. Unity is being weaponized.
Yeah.
Where 100%. It is like in the name of Christian community or the reputation of the church or all the things. Unity is being weaponized in this movie and in modern society as well.
Yeah. As though the person speaking truth is disunifying.
Right.
Instead of the systems perpetuating abuse being disunifying. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
It's a form of victim blaming. There is no, I don't think there's been a single sort of situation that I have interviewed with survivors from religious spaces where the victim was not called to a meeting, where the perpetrator was forced to confess some aspect, however menial and however incomplete, of his offenses. And the victim was consistently mandated to forgive and then consistently mandated into silence. Mm-hmm. It would be 100%. I've done over 100 and probably 110, 115 interviews. Mm-hmm. 100% of the time. So yeah. We have a problem as it relates to forgiveness and accountability and allowing people to speak.
Okay. Any other big, I wanted to kind of, it's 10:04. So I wanted to wrap up a little bit, but one of the things that happened afterwards, one of my friends that came with me works with getting children out of abusive situations into safety. And she was just like kind of mad at the end, because the movie ends with the women leaving, which is a powerful female imagination and an act of imagination. We're going to go do something else. In real life, by the way, because they didn't speak the dialect and all that, in real life, they don't leave. They stay. Just that's another thing to keep in mind, which is, But she said afterwards, that's dumb, because what are they going to do? Like, there's no plan. Like, she's like, I cannot, like she said, the amount of times I've removed a child from a harmful situation without a good plan, and then it just turns out that they get re-harmed. You know, she's like, I would consider this act an act of baloney. Like, if there's, where are they going to? Because you can't just go from, you have to go to something. And so she would, and we were just like, get over it, man. There's so many good things in this movie. Like, stop it. Like, it's, and then when I actually read about the real story again, I was like, yes. And I think this is part of our desire and our hope as we imagine possibilities of faith leading us to better, different, you know, collaborative, genuinely just, good, beautiful spaces, that we need to prepare those places. Like, there needs to be something for people to go to. You can't just leave. You must actually go somewhere and land somewhere. And this is like, you know, restored voices in your work, Lorianne, and Hagar's voice, and also movements in the church where the church needs to, people within that faith structure that are listening to Jesus need to create alternative places of safety and belonging and goodness and truth and beauty, because people need some place to go. And that was a big, you know, the ending was just them leaving, and it was beautiful in many ways, because you felt the strength of the resolve of the community and children. Oh, we didn't even talk about the children piece, about like, what age do the boys come, like, and what age is too late, and
that one male character and what he represents. There's so much more to say.
There is. We could talk for hours and hours and hours, but that would be too lengthy. But the themes around men and masculinity and when perpetration starts and when change is malleable and you know, and what did they ask the men for? Nothing ever.
Yeah, that's right. I've asked for zero. I've asked for nothing. That woman says my whole life, I've asked for nothing.
Wouldn't it be ironic? The first thing we do is ask them to leave. Do you remember she said that? The older lady, you know, so the conversation is expansive and really virtually endless. And I hope these conversations happen in, you know, talk shows and women's tables and with their daughters. And what do we ask of men? You know, where is the bar?
And for the record, if you haven't seen the movie yet, we highly recommend you see it and have discussions about it. I think that's where the real power is. But there is a male character, a dominant male character in the film that is not allowed to lead. So he's there to serve. And there's a couple moments where he just naturally tries. And then everyone's like, nope, that's not what you're here for. And he gets, and he's serving. But there is this, and he's different from all the rest. And that's stated, you know, he's safe in a way. He's been outside and he's come back. So his mother was someone that raised some concerns and left. And then he was university educated, and then he returned to the community. So he's a very interesting, he's sort of an ally, but a very passive one, it would seem to me. And then even how that left, you know, I just was like, anyway, there's a lot to say about that male character.
But it would be, to me, a tragedy to end this conversation without pointing to a moment that is so instructive for us across the board, which is in the domestic violence train of thought in this plot line, Yeah. When the mother says to the daughter, I'm sorry. Like, I know that these dynamics are complicated in our institutions. I get why we agonize over how to respond. But here, this movie gives a 3-sentence example of just how simple it is. Mm-hmm. It was simply a heartfelt acknowledgement of deep regret that was believable, and an actual owning of what went wrong. So she says to her daughter, I'm so sorry. And then there's just this heavy silence. And then she says, and she's crying, and you feel it off of her. I'm sorry for what I thought. Like, I don't remember what her 3 sentences are, but like what I thought, I'm sorry I didn't take action. And she says, I'm sorry that I taught you the things that caused you to believe that this was okay.
Yeah,
it's 3 sentences.
Uh-huh. Right.
It's that simple. It is that simple. And I know there's ramifications and complications of all of it. But like, you guys, this is not rocket science. How to turn the ship is just not rocket science. So I just.
It's complex, though, because then she goes back that night. Remember?
Yeah. Yeah, but the mother tries
to... Oh, the daughter does.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, the mother tries to stop.
Oh, yeah.
Which I thought was an actual act. Like it was an act of... Not only am I sorry, but I'm going to try to protect you from the situation if I can.
Yeah. You're totally right. The dynamics of abuse are crazy complex. What I mean is church institutions that are trying to figure out how to respond. It's like science.
Yes, that's right.
So I have 2 things I want to say. Number one, if anybody wants to go to the show, I recommend watching the trailer and trying to desensitize yourself. There's 2 really good trailers. I think I watched the 2 trailers about 20 times each because I knew it was going to be rough. So I was trying to prepare my nervous system to not, you know, disintegrate. And so that's just a suggestion. You don't have to, but it helped me for sure. And the other thing that I wanted to finish with saying, and then I will fall silent, is that the women said at the end of the movie, there are 3 things that we are entitled to. Number one, we want our children to be safe. Mm-hmm. Number 2, we want to be steadfast in our faith. Number 3, we want to think. I think those are just universal truths that women want.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we are entitled to.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I loved it. I think if there is a, they held complexity, they, you know, shared that dynamic energy that needs to happen in having robust conversations, even with ourselves, but also with others. They made room and space for people to be different from. We didn't even talk about the one woman's response to her trauma as like ending being female and refusing to talk.
Oh, right.
Yeah. That's a lot. And I know like some, I saw some religious person say this is like a pro-trans movie or something ridiculous. I was like, no, this is a trauma movie, a trauma-informed movie. That idea of like, I just refuse now to be this. And I'm not talking anymore. Like she just refuses to talk to any adults, only children. And anyway, there's so many powerful things, guys. Thanks for talking about women talking and for your thoughts and for all the work that we're doing to help a righteous, beautiful exodus happen, not just from oppression, but to promise and beauty and truth. And we'll keep letting the stars guide us. Huh?